新英汉口译实践第三合第二十五单元教育权利
Unit 25 The Right to Formal Education
篇章交传
Passage for Consecutive Interpretation Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Last week, we featured a column by ESL specialist Doris Parton, who, on the basis of the results from a recent UNICEF study comparing educational inequality in the 24 nations of the OECD, lamented the state of American public schooling. Her analysis of the contrast between U.S. suburban schools, usually good, and urban schools, typically bad, struck me as fair.But I must take exception to some of the assertions in her article. Ms. Parton refers to America's number 18 position in the Educational Disadvantage League in the UNICEF report. I was prepared to be shocked. The gap between the best and the worst public schools, or between the average and the lowest educational attainment of pupils, was greater in America than in any OECD country,except Germany, Denmark, and less remarkably, Spain, Italy, Greece, and Portugal. Wealthy, suburban, and small town, and ultra-homogeneous Finland shines in slot 3. While wealthy, suburban, and small town, but far less homogeneous Denmark, occupies slot 20, Canada and Australia rank 4th and 5th, the U.S. 18th.No doubt the rankings bear some relation to classroom realities, but I wonder if it is reasonable to go too deeply into lamentation mode. Finland and Denmark are culturally very similar countries, but one clear difference between them lies in the size and origin of their immigrant populations. Finland has very few immigrants. In contrast, Copenhagen, the Danish capital,has substantial neighborhoods of poorly integrated immigrants and many schools where little Danish is heard on the playground. In this respect, Denmark resembles Germany. Might the presence of large numbers of immigrants not explain some of the performance problems in American schools? And not just any immigrants. The children of poor, ill-educated families from societies like Mexico, where few peasants escape poverty through the village school,Canada and Australia are also wealthy English-speaking nations with sizable immigrant populations, but their governments carefully dole out visas on the basis of would-be immigrants' education and professional background. In other words, these nations absorb foreigners fully aware of the economic value of education, having already used it to better their lives. When boatloads of much more ordinary Asians approach the shores of Australia, on the other hand, they are received coolly. For better or worse, official U.S. immigration policy is not geared towards this sort of social selection, and whatever the policy may be, the country cannot control the illegal influx over its southern border. For historical reasons, this problem does not keep me awake at night.America has been flooded with illiterate Irish, Italian, and Slavic peasants in the past. Yet in three generations, the newcomers were almost wholly absorbed into the American middle class. Given half a chance, the new peasant arrivals from Mexico and farther south will follow the same broad pattern. Problems in the first generation, adjustment in the second, advancement in the third.What particularly troubles me about Ms. Parton's article is the statement that we need to stop blaming poverty, parents, or the home environment for the difficulty a child has in learning. Poverty, I agree, is not directly to blame for such difficulties, but parents and the home environment, on the other hand, are crucial factors. Those immigrant parents who recognize at least the economic value of education,will be the first to see that their kids cooperate with school teachers. If parents take school seriously, by and large, children will too, especially in the early years, when literacy skills are being mastered, and they will thrive even in run-down school buildings. Taking school seriously may mean that a parent forgoes some employment opportunities for a while to make sure that children are doing something constructive after school. Homework, reading and supervised play, not watching garbage on TV or hanging out in the street. The worst impact of poverty is in making it harder for immigrant parents to assume this role. Ms. Parton seems to attribute the success of children in school above all to good teachers armed with an effective methodology. I am second to none in my praise of the dedicated pedagogue. But the record of teachers in rescuing children from families where what kids do in school is of no interest to the parents or parent is not, in my view, encouraging. Most often, at least one of the parents has to be reached in order to guarantee that children make progress in school. Where children respect a parent and know that he or she demands good behavior in school, even mediocre or loutish teachers can pull off the trick of producing modestly literate and numerate children, which is not to wish bad teachers on children, but merely to suggest where the key to success lies in most cases, with the parent who makes sure the child does its homework.
第26单元, 减债图贫.
Unit 26, Debt Reduction and Poverty Elimination.
篇章交传.
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
I want today to set debt reduction in the context of development challenges of poor countries. My key message is that we need a step change in the way we look at the purpose of debt relief, from ending debt to ending poverty. As a chief economist at the World Bank said in a Guardian article last week, debt relief is a strong anti-poverty weapon, but it must be part of a broader development strategy. Now is a time for new thinking, and the task is an urgent one. One out of four people in the world live in absolute poverty. Deserts are spreading, forests are shrinking, and seas are being overfished. With projections of growing strain on all the natural resources of the world, and the likelihood of increasing violent conflict and calamity arising from that, it is not just morally imperative that we act to give the poor of the world the chance to get out of poverty. It is in our interest to do so. There can be no secure future for our children and grandchildren unless we build a more equitable world. The world will only be able to achieve these goals by concerted action. Here, Britain can make a significant contribution. Our international links are unique. We have all kinds of influence, the United Nations, the European Union, and the Commonwealth. We have significant influence in the World Bank and the IMF. As you will know from our white paper on international development, the strategy and the targets are already in place. We are pushing on all fronts for their adoption and monitoring. We are the first generation with the possibility of working systematically to eliminate poverty and illiteracy, not just to reduce them or to alleviate them, but to eliminate them. This evening, I am going to argue that debt relief should only be given in the context of partnerships to eliminate poverty, that HIPC is critical and could be enhanced, that there may be a case for additional debt relief in the light of the government's total debt servicing of internal as well as external debt, and that progress requires continuing concessional resource flows. So, we need to implement this step change in the goal of debt relief, from ending debt to ending poverty. Debt reduction from now on has to be linked to the international development strategy. That may sound obvious, but it is not what we do at present. Current debt initiatives are based on the idea of restoring the external sustainability of a country, calculating what can be paid to external creditors. I do not want to belittle this. It is extremely important for a poor country to restore its ability to function effectively in the international economy. This is reinforced by the opportunities provided for accelerated development if poor economies are able to participate in a rapidly globalizing world. But my point is that the level of debt relief itself is not designed to address broader development objectives. Debt is not evil in itself. Borrowing for high-quality investment is clearly beneficial and appreciated. The aim should be for countries to borrow prudently along a sustainable path to fund priority investments. This requires a clear debt management strategy. We have recently agreed to provide core funding, alongside other donors, for the Program of Debt Relief International, which works with HIPC countries to develop debt management strategies. To make real progress, the government and people of each country must develop a clearly defined approach to this complex challenge. The priorities of government budgets are obviously central to this. We need to look at the expenditure necessary to achieve poverty reduction objectives and then see how debt reduction can contribute to making it possible. We must always remember debt relief is a means to an end, not an end in itself. For a government with a commitment to the poor, debt relief has some important benefits. Firstly, it frees the government's own resources to fund development. It is surely right that as soon as possible, a government should, for example, fund its basic health or education programs from its own revenue. It gives a strong sense of local ownership and responsibility. Secondly, it is a way of signaling donor support for the long-term programs of a government. Thirdly, it can help to stimulate the investment necessary for long-term growth. But, of course, sometimes debt relief will not be the right option. Aid funds used for debt relief have an opportunity cost. Sometimes, money will be better spent on direct support for the health or education sectors, or to promote sustainable livelihood. The key question to ask is what the role debt relief plays in eliminating poverty.
第27单元, 新贵调查.
Unit 27, A Survey of the New Rich.
篇章交传.
Passage for consecutive interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
What the markets give, they can quickly take away. The bursting of the dot-com bubble made this painfully clear, and Jay Walker was exhibit number one. Early this year, it was reported that building work had stopped on the mansion of the founder of Priceline, a once-hot internet stock. In 1999, Forbes magazine had ranked Mr. Walker as the 53rd richest American, with an estimated net worth of $4.1 billion. This year, he was a long way off the list. As people get wealthier, the task of managing and retaining their riches gets increasingly complex. As well as decisions about how to invest the money, there are tax planning issues that can make a huge difference to how much wealth survives to be passed on to the next generation. There is fierce competition to provide advice and manage the wealth of the new rich. Many banks now claim to offer a one-stop service, including asset management, tax planning, and accounting. However, the quality of this integrated product varies widely. The new rich are less loyal to their private bank and are more prepared than people with old money to switch to one with a better track record. The sleepy Swiss private banks are waking up to the growing threat posed by foreign competitors, especially American ones. Private banking is labor-intensive, with each highly paid banker dedicated to at most a handful of clients whom he knows well. A traditional Swiss private bank probably has little interest in customers with marketable assets of less than $5 million. However, this is a market that most financial services firms find highly attractive, because it can be run out of an existing branch network and is thus supposedly scalable, i.e., can be cheaply expanded. A number of academic studies suggest that a company should pass out of the control of the founding family within 3 generations. Only 4% of firms survive into the ownership of the 4th generation. Many family firms in continental Europe and Latin America are now coming on the market, having been inherited by a generation much more financially sophisticated than the founders. Asians are less keen on this form of diversification because many of them still aim to build a business dynasty. An abundance of money is no miracle cure for all human ills, as the new rich are discovering. What is different this time is that there are so many of them. Millions of families have triumphed against necessity. They are, by any historical standard, rich. So they are ready to pursue happiness. But this is where the problem begins. They don't know where to find it. There are specific problems associated with being, and particularly with becoming, exceptionally wealthy. The world's leading private banks now encourage some of their clients to seek advice from psychoanalysts on their relationship with their wealth. There has been plenty of publicity about sudden wealth syndrome, also known as affluenza. Sudden wealth syndrome was named by Stephen Bolbart and Joan D. Furia, two psychologists who, in 1997, set up the Money, Meaning, and Choices Institute, MMCI, to explore the psychological opportunities and emotional challenges of having and inheriting money. For many of the new rich, wealth meant a leap in social class. They had no expectation of wealth, nor history of knowing how to live with it. The American dream has always been about the possibility of personal advancement up the social scale, but traditionally, the dream was really about going from working class to middle class, not working class to rich, and certainly not within a few years. Car, house, work, the whole way of life. The new rich have often undergone a radical change in identity. Though the bursting of the dot-com bubble has made some MMCI clients a lot less wealthy, most are still rich by any definition. But gone is the belief that instant wealth automatically accompanies hard work and good ideas. It was a wake-up call to a generation who grew up in affluence. The new rich learned a lesson about the fragility of wealth that their parents and grandparents did from the Great Depression and the Second World War. A more general source of worry for the truly rich is that their wealth makes them the target of crooks and lunatics. To reduce the risk, they make growing use of private security firms and often live in well-protected gated communities or secure private estates. Without the need to work, wealthy people's children can become demotivated and purposeless. They can find it difficult to develop an appreciation of the value of money because they have never been short of it. They can also feel crushed by the pressure to match the achievement of the creator of the wealth they are enjoying, not least from the family itself.
第28单元, 宽容文化.
Unit 28, The Culture of Tolerance.
篇章交传.
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Distinguished colleagues, the events of September 11th were a grim reminder to all of us of the absolute necessity to vigorously combat terrorism and extremist violence anywhere and everywhere. They were intended as an attack on the open society we cherish and on the values of democracy and human rights on which it is built. They were meant to strike at the very foundations of peace among nations and civilizations. Their purpose was to sow hatred, violence, and destruction among the nations and civilizations of the world. Our response to this challenge must be a dialogue among civilizations, a commitment to the peaceful resolution of differences, to tolerance and mutual respect. That is a challenge that requires a clear understanding, however, of our own fundamental values, values we must defend but also live up to. There is no direct and certainly no casual link between these two challenges, but they will nevertheless determine the course of the 21st century. A response to both challenges will decide whether we live in a world of escalating cultural, religious, and ethnic conflict, or in a world in which different civilizations coexist peacefully. Our world will always be defined by the diversity of our societies and cultural traditions. If there is respect and tolerance for our differences, they will enrich all our lives. But if such differences are exploited for political ends, they may cause untold harm. What is the real meaning of tolerance and dialogue in this whole process? Let me start with a general comment. This dialogue can only succeed if Orient and Occident engage in it on equal terms. Tolerance, then, means respecting the fact that civilizations are different. Dialogue, as I see it, means seeking a common understanding of those values that will guide us through the 21st century. This kind of intercultural dialogue is a very ambitious goal. To achieve it, we must all begin work at home, within our own societies. We, for our part, are striving to develop and practice the kind of tolerance I have described. That needs time, and in some cases requires difficult judgments. Let me give you an example. Should the Quran be taught in German schools? And who should do the teaching? It is just one of the many practical issues that have led to intensive debate in Germany, among the general public, in the political arena, and also before the courts. But in the course of these debates, we have steadily deepened our understanding of what it really means to be a tolerant society. Without a solid common basis, however, only monologue, not dialogue, is possible. Is there general and wholehearted support for the values enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the relevant international conventions? Do we really share the same understanding of the importance of individual liberty and other fundamental human rights? These questions include the issue of the role and rights of women. Their rights must be an integral and prominent part of this dialogue. Once we have reached a clear and solid consensus on those values we hold in common, it is up to political leaders to endorse these rights. They must defend this spirit of openness in society, defend it against the modern fundamentalism that seek to impose their own absolute truths. For me, this also means people must be free to practice their religion. The way minorities are treated is the true test of the culture of tolerance for which I am calling. True tolerance is an expression of self-confidence, not weakness. It is only when we succeed with this dialogue within our societies that we can really reap the fruits of a dialogue between our societies. Let us make a real effort to move away from a culture of lecturing each other to a culture of learning from each other. There have been periods of appalling intolerance in the history. Today, however, it is our common responsibility for the future, which makes it imperative that our dialogue is substantive and successful. A future we will shape not just as neighbors, but also when we ourselves live in the midst of societies less familiar to us than our own, not only in the political arena, but also in schools and the media, we must come to an understanding of what I call a culture of tolerance. That is, what we must work for, each one of us beginning in our own country, yet also all together.
第29单元, 商务会计.
Unit 29, Business Accounting.
篇章交传.
Passage for consecutive interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
People in the business world all use accounting terms and concepts to describe the resources and the activities of every business. Today, I'll talk about the function of accounting. The underlying purpose of accounting is to provide financial information about an economic entity. Financial information about a business is needed by managerial decision makers to help them plan and control the activities of the organization. Financial information is also needed by outsiders, owners, creditors, potential investors, the government, and the public, who have supplied money to the business or who have some other interest in the business that will be served by information about its financial position and operating results. Developing and communicating this information is the role of the business organization's accounting system. An accounting system consists of the methods, procedures, and devices used by an entity to keep track of its financial activities and to summarize these activities in a manner useful to decision makers. Regardless of whether the accounting systems are simple or sophisticated, three basic steps must be performed with data concerning financial activities. The data must be recorded, classified, and summarized. Step 1. Recording financial activity. The first function of an accounting system is to create a systematic record of the daily business activity in terms of money. For example, goods and services are purchased and sold. Credit is extended to customers, debts are incurred, and cash is received and paid out. These transactions are typical of business events which can be expressed in monetary terms and must be entered in accounting records. The mere statement of an intent to buy goods or services in the future does not represent a transaction. The term transaction refers to a completed action rather than to an expected or possible future action. Of course, not all business events can be objectively measured and described in monetary terms. Therefore, we do not record in the accounting records such events as the death of a key executive or a threat by a labor union to call a strike. Step 2. Classifying data. A complete record of all business activities usually amounts to a huge volume of data, too large and diverse to be useful to decision makers such as managers and investors. Therefore, the data must be classified into related groups or categories of transactions. For example, grouping together those transactions in which cash is received or paid out is a logical step in developing useful information about the cash position of a business. Step 3. Summarizing the data. To be useful to decision makers, accounting data generally must be highly summarized. A complete listing of the sales transactions of a company such as Sears, for example, would be too long for anyone to read. The employees responsible for ordering merchandise need sales information summarized by product. Store managers will want sales information summarized by department, while Sears top management will want sales information summarized by store. Outsiders, such as the company's stockholders and the Internal Revenue Service, probably will be most interested in a single sales figure which represents the total sales of the entire company. These three steps we have described, recording, classifying, and summarizing, are the means of creating accounting information. However, the accounting process includes more than creating information. It also involves communicating this information to interested parties and interpreting accounting information to help in the making of specific business decisions.
第30单元,绿色旅游.
Unit 30. Green Tourism.
篇章交传.
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I am very pleased to welcome you all this morning to take part in this forum co-organized by this city and the United Nations Department for Economic and Social Affairs. I am honored to speak as the host of an event that will help us map out a sustainable future for our cities. The issues that delegates will present and debate over these 2 days are ones that concern all of us here, as we seek to ensure that economic growth can develop hand in hand with social progress and protection of our natural environment. It is always a challenge to try to pinpoint what we mean by sustainable development, given the wide spectrum of subjects it may involve. The 2002 World Summit in Johannesburg used the theme of People, Planet, Prosperity to convey the key elements of sustainability. This is a simple and straightforward formula that helps to express in more accessible terms the noble concept of sustainable development, i.e., our future depends on finding a proper balance between the creation of wealth, equal opportunities for our citizens, and a respect for our natural and cultural heritage. The Johannesburg World Summit showed clearly that there is widespread concern in all sectors of the global society for the sustainability of our current way of living. Many nations responded with a high level of commitment to achieving positive results from the summit. One of the key outcomes of the Johannesburg Summit was, of course, the plan of implementation, which aimed to set out key areas for action in pursuit of sustainable development worldwide. We have taken good note of this document, as our local strategy for putting the principles of sustainable development into practice begins to take shape. In recent years, we have sought gradually to make sustainable development an underlying principle in the formulation of new policies and programs. In putting forward major new proposals, we require government agencies to critically evaluate the sustainable development angle and to consider its full implications before making a final decision. Our aim is to ensure that in taking forward the programs needed to consolidate our position as a modern city, we do not compromise the quality of life of our citizens, now or in the future. Governments, both at the city and national levels, obviously have a pivotal role to play in implementing the principles of sustainable development. But the Johannesburg World Summit also recognized that it is essential for people and organizations outside governments, including the business sector and civil society, to also play a leading role in pushing towards more sustainable practices and lifestyles. Our experience in recent years has brought into sharp relief the importance of addressing the principles of sustainable development in the governance of our cities. In particular, the needs to maintain strong networks of support for our citizens and to preserve a healthy and pleasant natural environment have become clear priorities in the vision for our further development. To achieve this vision of a society that is economically vibrant and socially inclusive and that values its natural and cultural heritage, we need to do more than simply promote and encourage the concept of sustainable development. We have to implement them as a core feature of our future plans and projects. The Johannesburg Plan of Implementation rightly emphasizes the need for concrete action in this regard, including the setting of targets and a commitment to partnership between the various sectors of society. Furthermore, we must not see the challenges to sustainability as resting only within the confines of our own cities. Rather, we should look to work closely with our neighbors in addressing these challenges, giving due weight to the concept of thinking globally and acting locally. Our economic growth, our social progress, and our ability to act as conscientious stewards of our natural environment will depend very much on cooperation and the sharing of information with neighboring cities. For us, working together with our neighboring cities as partners to build on our respective strengths is important. I am optimistic that we will find durable ways of dealing with the objective of making our cities better for future generations. This United Nations Leadership Forum is an important step towards greater understanding of how we can promote the sustainable development of our cities. It also provides a platform for the renewal of existing partnerships and for further extending partnerships and cooperation within the region. I look forward to each member playing its part in helping to forge a sustainable future in which the people of this region and of this planet at large will prosper. I wish you all a very fruitful and enjoyable forum. Thank you.